Welcome to Lit with Charles, a podcast on all things literary where I interview people who've either written books or have interesting things to say about them. If you're like me, then you love reading, but maybe you're not sure what you should be reading, or maybe you feel intimidated by conversations around books. The main aim of this podcast is to make literature exciting and accessible, and hopefully make you discover new books and authors that are off the beaten track. In this podcast, I try to cover all genres and types of books, from serious historical nonfiction to trashy novels, and I talk to all sorts of authors so that it never feels like the same episode twice.
Along the process, I had done some interviews with some of George Floyd's closest friends and family. I just wanted to learn more about him. Particularly because whenever people started talking about him, their eyes would sort of light up. And when you'd say, tell me a story about him, they'd just keep on going. They had so many. And I thought, if I ever got the opportunity, there was so much that we couldn't do within the structure of a newspaper series that could really help shed light on who this person was.
On May 25th, 2020, in Minneapolis, a black man named George Floyd was murdered by a white police officer named Derek Chauvin, who put his knee on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, thus asphyxiating him. That tragic event had an immediate global impact, sparking off demonstrations and riots, not just in the US, but across the world. Instantly, George Floyd became an international symbol of racial injustice. But who was George Floyd? Where did he come from? What was he like? What was his life? And what did it come to represent in the aftermath of his murder? These questions are all addressed in the book co-authored by my guest today, Robert Samuels and Tolu Olorunipa. The book is called His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and Struggle for Racial Justice, which won the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction this year. It's a superbly researched book, which provides a look at George Floyd's ancestry and how the trauma of slavery and discrimination is typically passed down in black families in America. And it also examines the interactions of a man like George Floyd with institutions like school, the police department, the neighborhood he grew up in, and how all these interactions are at best difficult, at worst fatal. In today's interview, I ask Robert Samuels how this book came to be, what the research was like, given the raw emotions that must have been omnipresent. This is obviously a difficult subject, but one that must be discussed, and this book certainly helps to open eyes and provoke thoughts and generate these important conversations. Where were you when you first heard about the murder of George Floyd? At that moment in time, did you foresee the massive impact that this event would have on the U.S. and on the world?
So it's interesting. When I heard about George Floyd, I was actually having an argument with a friend of mine from high school about systemic racism. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about another incident that happened in Central Park between these two people, a white woman named Amy Cooper and a black guy named Christian Cooper.
Yeah, it was a story about a dog on a leash.
And so we were getting into a big fight about it because he thought Amy Cooper was kind of justified in what she did. And it horrified me. And I said to him, you know, my issue with this is that if I died tomorrow, the first question people would ask is, what did I do to deserve it? No one would ask people I know about my hopes and dreams or who I loved or what I wanted to be. And people would assume I had done something to deserve it. And a few hours later, I learned about George Floyd. And when I did not sort of have the journalistic instinct to be involved. I felt I had seen this movie before. I had covered the protests in Ferguson. I had been to mass shootings and covered mass shootings in Newtown and in Dallas. And it can be a little bit frightening as a reporter, particularly as a black reporter, because tensions are high. Sometimes police don't believe who you are. And I didn't want to be close to it. But over time, as the story kept on continuing and the protests got bigger, and there were these larger conversations about what this means and the realities of racism, not just in America, but across the world, I felt obligated to lend a hand journalistically in whatever way I could.
Were you at all surprised by the scale of the reaction to the murder of George Floyd? Maybe even surprised that it went beyond American borders and has such a global resonance? Or on the contrary, did you sort of foresee that and think, well, you know, after Ferguson, it was a matter of time before something like this happened and the reaction would be even bigger this time around? Or what was your state of mind?
I was legitimately surprised because we had seen terrible things happen before and we had seen a lot on camera. But there are a few things that immediately felt different. I mean, in my personal life, one of the things that happened was one weekend, I started getting money through Venmo from people who I did not have close relationships with, but they had known me from church or from college, and they had read online that you should do something like that for a Black friend. And people thought this was something that would be good to do. And I saw people sort of taking these different steps that went beyond just going to the streets and protesting. And it felt like there was this snowball effect that was going on, likely propelled by the pandemic, and that people didn't have a lot more to think about or focus on, that was making it something different. Now, in retrospect, after doing all this research and thinking about what Tolu and I spent, you know, more than a year of reporting on, it feels like, oh, of course, this incident would yield that kind of response. But in the moment, it didn't feel that way. It felt organic and new and like something strange and big was happening across the country.
And so at what point did what seems to have been an initial reporting assignment turn into a desire to write a book? And what was the process to take it from a journalistic article to a big, important book?
We started with the series in the Washington Post that was called George Floyd's America. And there are seven reporters who worked on it. I was one of them. And my co-author, Tolu Olorunikpe, was another. And the idea was that so many people were talking about systemic racism, but they didn't really know what it meant, or they didn't know what it looked like in the actual lived life of a person. So we thought that if we looked at different institutions that George Floyd had interacted with throughout his life, we might be able to reveal something for people about how systemic racism operates. Along the process, I had done some interviews with some of George Floyd's closest friends and family, and I just wanted to learn more about him, particularly because whenever people started talking about him, their eyes would sort of light up. When you'd say, tell me a story about him, they'd just keep on going. They had so many. And I thought, if I ever got the opportunity, there was so much that we couldn't do within the structure of a newspaper series that could really help shed light on who this person was. But more so than thinking about who he was, I was learning so much about the history of our country and thinking about different ways different institutions interact with each other, like the healthcare system, what a police officer does when they see you. All these things, it started becoming a lot clearer to me. And I was actually working on another book project at the time. And I was kind of hoping an agent would call and say, hey, have you thought about this as a book? Which is what happened, thankfully. So the process was, we knew we had this really great opportunity powered by the testimonies that we had seen in the original pieces to tell a story that could resonate with people, because the original series had resonated with people. But even more than that, we also knew that everything hadn't been settled. And in journalistic language, people would call me an immersion reporter, an enterprise reporter. And that because we had forged relationships with so many people who had known George Floyd, that we'd have sort of a very unique opportunity to follow them as the world sort of figured itself out. And from a reporter's perspective, it would seem like such a waste if we didn't give the opportunity to tell that story to the world.
But so when you were doing all this research and meeting his loved ones and his friends and family, it must have been at a very raw moment where a lot of emotions were unprocessed. How did that make your research more difficult, or did it, on the contrary, make it more real, or how did that impact that? I mean, you're dealing with people who've just lost a loved one, and it must still be very raw and powerful research process, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, in reporting, you don't really know how folks are going to respond to the questions. And so you have to be accommodating, you have to be nimble. That's a part of it. And when we had first started really dealing with folks who had known George Floyd, it had been a couple months from the original protests. Things had sort of settled down. They could think about their place in a way that they wouldn't have been able to, you know, in May or June or July after George Floyd had immediately died. They had some time. But the hardest moments for me would be the days when I'd sort of sit behind them at a press conference or as they're waiting for something to happen. And you could just see their minds just flit from place to place, trying to make sense of how did I get to this position?
Wow.
And those were really hard moments to sit with people who are going to sit with them. And so when we think about writing, we think about, particularly with nonfiction or with interviews, like we think about the things that are said. But some of the hardest moments as a reporter were to sit with the times when there wasn't anything being said, you know, and to try to find a way to convey that sort of tension and that sort of meaning to the reader. So a lot of the scenes in the book, particularly after George Floyd dies, Tola and I were there for it. We had experienced them with the people as they were experiencing them. And then it turned out that the great respite, a lot of times for them, was to talk about the stories that enhanced the first parts of the book, you know, where George Floyd is alive and they had this chance to vivify him. I try not to speak for anyone who he interviewed, but, you know, I think there were times when they liked having Tolu and me around because they had someone to call up and say, oh, I remember this story about George Floyd, XYZ. And, you know, it became clear to me that that was a part of their process.
A part of their grieving process.
Yeah.
I think what struck me in your book was how well you balanced George Floyd as an individual, a human being. He's a man and he's got a life, and that life is brutally cut short. And George Floyd, the symbol, and what he represents for people who might not have known him, but what his murder represents for them. How are you managing that balance? Was that a conscious decision? Because one element might have been to say, okay, we end the book when he's murdered. But you made a conscious choice to tell the story of George Floyd, the aftermath, and the symbolism of what he represented. Where did that decision come from? How did you manage it?
I think there would have been nothing wrong with sort of doing a biography of George Floyd that was simply a cradle-to-grave biography of George Floyd. I think that has merit alone by itself. But we also knew that because of the research that we're doing and all the experts we were talking to about school systems and healthcare, all the records that we had seen about land loss and how it had filtered down to George Floyd's life, all of these moments where we were talking to police chiefs and politicians about their efforts to stem systemic racism and how they failed, we kept on seeing the echoes of them in George Floyd's life. And we knew that we didn't want to write a book that was simply just sort of a exploitative look at pain and to just traffic the reader through from tragedy through tragedy. What we needed to do was to help show that even before George Floyd was murdered, these same structures that would allow a police officer to think that it might be okay to put their knee on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds were governing throughout all of his life. And we did not want to do that in a rhetorical sense. You know, we wanted to do that from a sense of deep reporting with people who knew their stuff and people who might argue with folks who are, you know, on the completely liberal side of the spectrum or the conservative side of the spectrum. We wanted to be able to create something that didn't feel like an argument, but felt like a truism. And to do that, we had to do that sort of research. The other thing that was really important for me was to ensure that the work wouldn't just exist for the moment or for the people who had lived through 2020 with conscientiousness. Tolu and I wanted to make sure that people understood in 10 or 20 years that this moment was not just a blip in the radar. It was sort of like the world stopped for a good chunk of time, and then it figured out a way to move on. And we wanted to be able to document that, to make sure that it was simply more than a biography, that it would have resonance for people when they were looking at this sort of moment in American history, that they could look to the text and really understand the meaning of what George Floyd was. And for those who are living today, like you and me, we hoped that going through his path in a way that was serious about its reporting, you know, sobering in terms of its research, would help amplify the understanding of the tragedy of the life that was lost, that was saw lost. So we were trying to do two things.
Is there an element of also trying to create some unity in the aftermath of this event and or convince, you mentioned earlier, liberals and conservatives, is it a case of trying to convince people on the conservative side who might be reluctant or trying to reinforce on the liberal side, or what was your intention with regard to these different political angles?
Yeah, well, we wanted to tell the truth. And in my estimation, it's inherently apolitical, right? But we really wanted to see how much we could depoliticize this idea of whether systemic racism exists, whether this is a work of critical race theory or something like that. I mean, what we wanted to do was to put life, a life, in the proper context, the proper national context. And I think it's really hard to do that unless you look at different institutions and how they might have greeted George Floyd. You know, you cannot think about how he died and speculate whether Derek Chauvin was a rogue cop, right? We know he wasn't because our reporting showed that it was a technique he was trained to do. That
long history of
the history of it. You know, we don't want to speculate about why George Floyd was poor. You know, like we learned why he was poor because he grew up in a family that wealth was stripped for them, and that it was believed that the best way to literally survive in America was to keep your head down and work and provide for your family, but not do much else. And so, like, I think all of those things were really important so that when anyone, conservative or liberal, tries to make an argument, they can make an argument with the appropriate amount of research and understanding and context. So that's sort of what we were trying to do.
You just mentioned systemic racism in institutions. I'm also interested in the setting, the geographical setting of Minneapolis, which is where this tragic murder occurred. And in the book, it's presented initially as a place for a lot of Black people in George Floyd's entourage to get a fresh start, get clean. There's a network that helps people get back on their feet. But it turns out that actually it's nothing of the sort. And there's a bit of a veneer, a bit of a facade of liberalism. But underneath that facade, it's not so liberal. And there's a large amount of racism there. What was your perspective of the city when you were there? Did you find there was a big contrast with Houston, where George Floyd was from? Or did you sort of feel, man, that's more of the same, I'm getting the same vibes here that I would in other places?
Yeah, well, I spent a good chunk of time in Minneapolis, less so in Houston. Totally spent a good chunk of time in Houston, less so in Minneapolis. There are times when we switched off. But I think there are a few distinct things about Minnesota in general. And the first is that it's a place that really believes that they should do progressive work, you know, and I think that's a very rare thing for a state in the United States of America to want to do nowadays. They take pride in the fact that they are good, they care for their fellow man. And because of that, I think the gulf in understanding the tragedy that happened on video with George Floyd's murder was really hard for that community. And the sad thing of being a reporter is I've been in a lot of communities that have suffered spontaneous tragedy. And it always feels worse when that tragedy feels like it goes against the grain of what that community's identity is. So the place that I think most typified it for me until I spent time in Minneapolis was Newtown, Connecticut, when all those precious boys and girls got killed, which was a fairly affluent, nice, safe community. They couldn't believe it happened. And Minneapolis had that same feeling, that it looked like there was a broad trauma across the spectrum in the city because they could not wrap around this happening specifically in Minneapolis, that Minneapolis could become the nexus of racial disparities and inequality, even though all of the statistics would have said it would be a great candidate. Along the way, I would say to friends of mine who lived there, like, I could see myself moving here, but for all the things that I'm reporting about, you know, because it's sort of, it was very easy to get enraptured in sort of that veneer that everything is good. But then you also have to confront the realities that the disparities there are some of the largest in the country.
Do you think they've done a bit of a job in confronting those realities? In the 3 years since the murder of George Floyd, do you see any evolution, whether in Minneapolis or to make the question broader, more widely in the U.S.? How do you think?
I mean, I think there's been some. And it shows up in different ways, you know, like these large conversations that we were having before George Floyd died got settled really soon. You know, Splash Mountain in Disney World doesn't exist. Confederate statues came down, Confederate flags came down, right? And then policy-wise, we saw some things with policing. It's also true that now, 3 years later, we're seeing a very pronounced backlash, and it's unclear whether this backlash is kind of the last gasp of a fading thought or idea of how the country is, and, you know, their folks are raging until the dying of the light, or whether it's something that will be a true pronounced and prolonged confrontation. And that shows up in the discussions of policing now, in the discussions of books we read now. All of those things happened that were counter to what the universe had agreed to do after George Floyd was murdered.
Can you give me some examples on the backlash or some counter reactions that you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most interesting ones for me as a person who lives in the District of Columbia is that the District of Columbia had a bill to make permanent some of the police reforms, like banning chokeholds, stopping no-knock warrants, ending police car chases, stuff that became very politically salient across the board, across the country. You had 16 states who had changed their laws to ban those things. And in D.C., they were approved.
Mm-hmm.
3 years later, Congress, which has to sort of give a thumbs up or thumbs down to anything the District of Columbia does because it's not a state, many of the people who had supported bans on chokeholds and no-knock warrants voted against allowing those changes to be made permanent. So you saw a very distinct change amongst lawmakers about whether or not these steps were appropriate steps to take.
And what forces do you think were pushing them to change their minds in that time? Do you see, is it a police lobby or is it a gun lobby? Or who do you see as being the sort of political opponent on that chessboard?
Well, I think the winds of narrative in politics and in the national narratives, they change very quickly when there became a larger preoccupation about crime in this country. People changed. Mm-hmm. And it was easy to forget some of the lessons about what could happen if folks did not change, if those laws did not change. And so I think you're seeing that. I mean, there will always be lobbying in this country. Like, to me, that is a base of how politics operates. What was distinct about when George Floyd died was you even had folks in the police unions, and, you know, we talk about this in the book, who were on board with some of these changes. And, you know, even still, you didn't see them being carried out. And then on the larger scale, like, you know, we have a big discussion about what to read, who to believe, you know, when is the appropriate time for a child to learn that the country hasn't always acted as nobly as we think it should have. And those are very real hard debates that are going on. And it strikes me that no one's sort of dealing with the heart of the matter, which is, to me, are we ready as a country to start accepting the ills and sort of the bad behavior of our forebears? You know, like, are we willing to accept that things that were done in the past have resonance on the lives of people today, even if I had nothing to do with it?
Which is something that you write quite extensively in the book. Yeah. About George Floyd's family and ancestors and the pain and trauma they went through. Was that part of the intention to try and highlight how that impact, that multi-generational impact?
Yeah, we wanted to move the argument away from the idea of thinking about racism as something mean or nefarious that a person does intentionally to another person. That's why we thought it was really important to go back seven generations in George Floyd's line and tell the story of not just the enslavement, but what happened after people on his line were emancipated and were industrious and wealthy, and how none of that was able to withstand the gross, at that point, overt racism that allowed tax collectors to recapture 500 acres of land and strip them of wealth within a single generation. That is the overt thing that happened, right? But it's the residue of it that continues to stifle George Floyd's family all the way up until George Floyd. And sort of being able to say, like, it starts here. But when that stopped, it's not like everything faded away. You had to deal with the residue of the past, but you had to deal with the continuation of policies that allowed certain people in this country, namely white people, to maintain power over those who they deemed less deserving, who were Black. And so that's why we do it, because we want people to sort of see and feel that, like, when George Floyd comes into the world, it's not that these things happened a long time ago. When we heard the stories about the abuses of sharecropping, before we did this book, I used to think about something like sharecropping and as something very ancient, like I'd see it in black and white or sepia tones, you know? But the people who are telling me about being sharecroppers were living today. They were not ancient people. They lived and breathed those experiences. And I think it was really eye-opening for both Tolu and I to see that, oh, wait, no, this wasn't that long ago. The residue and the pain and the abuse is something that many people in this country still live with actively today.
Having done this research into George Floyd's family, did you and your co-author also do research on your own families and histories? Had you done that previously?
That's actually a pretty good question. Tolu's family is from Nigeria. He's a first-generation American. It's a little bit easier for him. But I sort of felt convicted by it to learn more about my family. And after the book was released, you know, I went to my ancestral home in Jamaica and visited the estate where my ancestors once worked. And I think carrying that legacy with me, sort of like the legacy of the Floyd family, it sort of felt weird that I didn't know as much about my own family. And I kept on sort of thinking and replaying to myself, and honestly, I don't fully know the answer of how might this story been different for the Floyds and so many people in America if they did not get the opportunity that my family largely got, which was the chance to recapture and own their land, which was something that was more common in the Caribbean. My family, again, is from Jamaica, because a lot of the colonists just left the island. And so what I think I've learned from the sort of like the broader takeaway is that the nature of history and how it affects people, it's constantly changing. And the life that we live today, it will affect and influence the ways we perceive the times in the past. So, right, George Floyd's life and how he died and the legacy that he had, all of that reshapes the legacy of his great-great-grandfather, right? It tells a story in a larger and different context.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of what I learned.
What, if anything, did you edit out of the book? You mentioned earlier it started as a reporting serial with multiple authors, so it must have been quite a big beast. And I'm presuming that then you would have had to narrow it down, pare it down into something book-sized. And so was there anything that you might have wished had stayed in the book that you had to cut out? Or
yeah. Well, I think there are two real limiting factors. You know, the publishing house had only asked us to write, I think, somewhere between 60 and 80,000 words. The book is twice as long. And Tolu and I were really set free at, honestly, it might have been longer. And they said, well, no one's going to. 400 pages is a lot to ask of a reader. And then, you know, like you saw G-Man and the book about Balanchine and now the book about Martin Luther King. And it's like, we could have been twice as long. But I think in sort of tangible aspects, things that we lost, they were sort of anecdotes about George Floyd that were replicated through other anecdotes that we had. I mean, there was this one story about George Floyd that I loved, and we couldn't figure out how to get it in the original series. And then I thought, well, this is great. We have a book. And we also couldn't really figure out how to get it into the book. It was about how he got mad at his nephew, Brandon, while watching a basketball game because he had missed a layup.
It reminded him of his missed catch.
Yeah. And so he, you know, he gets super upset. And, you know, Brandon says, "We were up by 50 points. Why does it matter?" And he goes, "You don't miss the easy chances in life." And every day he'd take Brandon out and they wouldn't be allowed to leave the court until Brandon made 50 layups in a row. And I just thought it was this like really impactful anecdote about George Floyd. The other thing was sort of the constriction of time. So when I think about things we left out, I think about interviews we just couldn't do or parts of the story we couldn't completely nail down because we did not have the privilege of time. And if, you know, we had, you know, another 6 months, maybe things would have turned out a little bit differently.
So you've recently moved from the Washington Post, where you were writing since 2011, to the New Yorker. I guess that's a very different form of writing and reporting, feature articles. And so what projects, either reporting or book writing, do you have on your horizon right now? What can we expect?
It's interesting. I'm still learning how to do it at the New Yorker. And I figured it might be a good slide from book writing to move to magazine writing. But I am still fascinated by so many of the themes that we had talked about in the book. Like a lot of the pieces I'm doing are looking at my large project as a journalist, which is trying to figure out how our country got so messed up, how we started hating ourselves. And the stories that I do kind of like take stabs at that theme. I would hope that, you know, in 30 or 40 years, that if people looked at the body of work that I'm completing at this time and over the past 4 or 5 years at the Washington Post, they'd be able to sort of like put together a theory of the country that includes the book. And so those are the things that I'm thinking about.
That's a very critical mission right now. And so that, it seems, from what I'm understanding, is your life's work.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I grew up in a very specific area of the Bronx. And I've had the privilege to have seen every state in this country. And I always wondered why, like, I never feel more patriotic than when I'm in a national park. Well, then, you know, like when I'm sort of like scaling mountains with strangers of different backgrounds and staring at big skies. And I think it really sort of has given me an appreciation about just how vast this country is. It's stunning to me that at any point you could take a person from the Bronx, you could take a person from Vermont, you can take a person from Kansas, a person from Minnesota, and they'd all say they were American. And they all would say they had the same fundamental beliefs. It's wild when you think about it. Now we see less of that. And I think there are a lot of interesting theories about why, but I think a part of it is that we don't get to encounter sort of like the natural beauty of a national park within looking at our fellow man. And that I would hope when we do stories or books like our book about George Floyd, that people are reminded about that sort of like beautiful humanity that we just have within us as Americans, you know, that there are still things that are shared.
So we're going to move on now to our quick question section where I just find out from you what your literary tastes and preferences are and what you've been reading. What's your favorite book that I've never heard of?
Alexander Heaven's Nowhere Man, to me, such a gorgeously written, kind of like subtle, wonderful book.
I haven't heard of it. Tell me more about it.
Yeah, it's about a refugee from Serbia or Bosnia who moves to Chicago, and it's about his sort of like finding a sense of place. It's just gorgeous. Alexander Heaven, who did not grow up speaking English, I think his most popular books, The Question and Pruno. But I just fell in love with his writing while I was in college. And I was so nervous about losing the book that I got another one when I moved from college to Miami. And then I moved again and I couldn't find it. And so now I actually have three copies of Nowhere wow. Man. But no, it's a really, really lovely, lovely literary book.
What have you read recently, say in the last 12 months, that you've really enjoyed and would recommend?
Oh, man. I love The Haunting of Haji Hotak by Jamil Kochai. Jamil's ability to create character, I think, is incredibly magical. And he has such, his writing style is so malleable. Like he can do stream of consciousness. He can do direct address.
Ooh, we like that.
Yeah. It's a collection of short stories about folks who had migrated from Afghanistan. And they're just sort of like wildly creative and thoughtful. And I mean, I just found myself immersed in all of them.
What single book would you take to a desert island?
The answer is The Grapes of Wrath, John Steinbeck, which is my favorite book.
Is that a book you feel you could reread and dive deeper in?
Oh my gosh.
Different readings?
Yeah. But I think it reminds us so much about the interconnectedness of life. And I just love sort of like the journey of migration, the family difficulty, and like those wonderful interchapters. And because I was writing with a co-author and also we were doing interviews at a feverish pace, I didn't do a lot of reading while we were doing the book, mostly because I was concerned about consistency of voice. And the thing that I allowed myself to read and reread were some of the interchapters and the conclusion, because I wanted the end of our book to have that sort of like same tenderness and same kind of like whisper landing as like the end of The Grapes of Wrath.
I sort of see it now that you mention it. Yeah. Now I'm like, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense.
You know, it was so funny. I had mentioned this to my editor, like I was in a conversation with my editor and another person at our book launch party. And someone said, why The Grapes of Wrath? And my editor really immediately went, the ending. And that was such a warm and wonderful feeling. But it was also sort of like being able to think about, you know, those departures when we sort of like slide away from the narrative of George Floyd and think about kind of like these larger national issues. And I thought that was something that Steinbeck did really well. And I feel like if you just had to read The Grapes of Wrath all your life, you can just find different kind of journeys within it to keep your mind occupied.
And finally, last question, what book changed your mind?
I recently read Locking Up Our Own by James Foreman Jr., which looks at Washington, D.C. between the 60s and the 90s and how these majority black governments instituted these really harsh crime laws. And as a person who had grown up in New York in the late 80s and 90s, I think I had sort of internalized some of the natural arguments that we heard about people who are dealing drugs, the menaces they were, people who are using drugs, the menaces they were. And I just never sort of questioned it in the way that Foreman presents it, and never really thought about some of the undercurrents about class and racial manipulation that were going on in terms of having people think about why folks were doing these sorts of things in their communities. And so it knocked me on my head in this like really interesting way.
Fascinating. When did you read this?
I read a part of it last year and I finished it mostly for a story that I am doing for The New Yorker like probably like 2 months ago.
Okay, so always open to changing your mind.
Yeah. It's very easy to change a journalist's mind. Like a reporter like me. My job is to go find information, and then I find it, and I'm like, oh, whoa, yeah.
I should have known that. That's a good answer.
Yeah.
Robert Samuels, thank you so much for your time. Really enjoyed speaking with you and talking about your book. His name is George Floyd. It was a pleasure to have that discussion with you. Thank you so much for your time.
No problem. Anytime.
Here is a recap of the books that Robert mentioned in the interview. His favorite book that I'd never heard of was Nowhere Man by Alexander Hemon, published in 2002 about an Eastern European immigrant in Chicago. His favorite book in the last 12 months was The Haunting of Haji Hotak and Other Stories by Jamil Kochai, published in 2022. It's a collection of short stories around people immigrating from Afghanistan. His book that he would take to a desert island was The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck, because it reminds us of the interconnectedness of life. And finally, the book that changed his mind was Locking Up Our Own by James Foreman Jr., published in 2017. James Foreman Jr. is a former public defender, and the book looks at the over-incarceration in the Black community. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Lit with Charles. If you have any suggestions or comments, you can always DM me on my Instagram account @litwithcharles. I try to reply to all my DMs. If you enjoyed this episode, you should definitely subscribe or follow me, and more importantly, tell your friends and family.